Before we start this episode, we wanted to let you know that it was recorded on Tuesday, November 23rd, before learning of the passing of Stephen Sondheim on Friday, November 26th, 2021. We spent so much of the conversation talking about and paying tribute to the Broadway legend and have decided to leave the conversation as is. Stephen was one of the most influential composers and lyricists, and if you've listened to our podcast over the last few years, you know how much we admired him as an artist and how much he will be missed. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Off to Broadway, the podcast where we deep dive into anything and everything musical theater from the comfort of my car. I'm Tara.
I'm Stefania.
And in today's episode, we're talking all about, finally, Tick, Tick, Boom. We've literally been talking about this on every single episode, how excited we were for this movie. And can I just say, right off the top, it is everything that I wanted and more.
It was so worth it. It was the most anticipated movie musical of the year. I mean, besides Diana, obviously.
Yeah.
But the most anticipated movie musical of the year. And it lived up to everything we'd hoped for. And more, I think.
Yeah. So I guess we should start this with our overall thoughts before we get into, like, relationship with the show. So, Steph, what are your overall thoughts of this movie?
I thought, as a directorial debut for Lin-Manuel Miranda, he, like, absolutely nailed this as an adaptation of a musical. It felt like a musical, and it felt grand and big and special, but it also felt, like, grounded in this person. And I think we can talk about, like, the many different specific things as to why that feels that way, but it felt like a musical, but it also felt like very human, and I think it struck a perfect balance, and it was wonderful.
I love this movie. I watched this movie on Friday, the day that it came out on Netflix, and I know you watched it a couple days later, but in between that, we actually went to Shaw Fest, and I, like, refrained from giving my full thoughts. I did say, though, after watching it on Friday, that everyone should see this movie. And I think that there is a lot in there for musical theater fans. Obviously, we will get to that in a little bit. But, I mean, we can talk about performances later, but I just want to get this out there. What a masterclass performance from Andrew Garfield in this movie. It is something that needs to be seen.
He's so good. He's so cute in this movie. Like, really, he's putting his full heart into the performance, and you see him just committing to playing this character. And I think finding him, or like him, he was such a perfect match for this character and for this role. And I think, like, we're very lucky that he learned to sing for this.
I know. It's funny. Every time I see him in something, I'm surprised that he's good. And I don't know why I'm still surprised. Like, he is a great actor and continues to show us that in everything that he's in. So it's funny to me that when I see him in something like this, and I'm like, wow, this may be his best performance that he's given to date. But then think back, and it's like, oh, he's every performance that he gives. I mean, you and I, big fans of The Amazing Spider-Man. Like, we love that Peter Parker.
This, I mean, I don't know. I think it might be because he's kind of, so earnest in his interviews. This is, like, a deep dive into Andrew Garfield. But I think whenever he does interviews, he's, like, so, like, over the top almost about, like, acting and his part and whatever. And so it's kind of like an eye roll sometimes. But then you see the work and you're like, okay, you're backing it up with this. You know, all the interviews he's doing when he was doing Angels in America, he's like, I am a gay man except for the act, and you're just like, Andrew, stop doing this. But then you're like, okay, actually you're, like, really good, and so I, like, you're over the top method, but, like, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, as we do in every episode when we discuss a movie musical, again, as I had said on, I think, like, our last episode, welcome to movie musical season. We are actually almost at the end of it. West Side Story is the final movie musical coming out for 2021. But this one, as Steph said, like, one of the most anticipated one that we've been waiting for. So to talk about Tick, Tick, Boom as a whole, what is your relationship to this musical, to this show?
So I don't know how long ago. Maybe I can check on my iTunes to see when I downloaded the song. But I heard the song Louder Than Words many years ago. I'm gonna like fact check myself on when I downloaded it to iTunes, which means ripped it from YouTube.
Yes.
And I was obsessed with that song. And so I downloaded Louder Than Words to my iTunes in the year 2012. So that's around the time when I heard that song for the first time. But that was really the only song I had a relationship with from Tick, Tick, Boom, probably before about a month ago, where in preparation for the movie, I was like, I want to listen to the original cast recordings. That original cast recording has Love of My Life, Raul Esparza on it. Jerry Dixon and Amy Spanger, just sounding amazing. But I love Raul Esparza, so hearing him sing these songs, he has such an amazing voice. And I think he also has like a super interesting tone of voice. So I think he's great on this album. So I knew that song really, really well. And I also knew it was from the creator of Rent, that it was from a musical, a one-man show that was, after he died, developed into a three-person show. So I had the backstory, but I hadn't like deep dived into all of the music or even kind of the plot of it.
Right. Much more than I knew of this musical. I knew that it was from Jonathan Larson, the creator of Rent, and that's really it. And I chose not to listen to the cast recording or the movie soundtrack before watching the movie. And I think that this is obviously like, it's a very easy to follow along story because it's basically his life. For anybody that
And also he's telling you what's going on for the whole movie, you know?
Yes,
you're talking to the audience, telling you.
I mean, we literally just watched a Lin-Manuel Miranda interview with Broadway.com right before recording. And he says, like, the audacity for Jonathan Larson to write a bio musical in his 20s. Like, who does that?
Excuse me, I think he was 30. That's the whole point.
At that point, he was definitely 30, 100%. But yeah, it's true. It is. It Tick, Tick, Boom is basically a bio musical. And I mean, the style of this movie, they add bits and pieces of his life that, like, I don't know if they 100% existed. We have like minimal information about what happened after 1996 because he sadly died. But in the time period of Tick, Tick, Boom, I think we're feeding off information here from the filmed versions of his like one-man show that are out there, and also his sister Julie is an executive producer on this movie, so she could fill in the bits and pieces. But I think it was a really, really smart approach to not just have the movie be basically the performance of Tick, Tick, Boom that Jonathan was giving, but to give us those like backstory of his life. And I don't know. He's such an interesting person. And I do think that watching this movie makes me want to learn more about the person that he was. But yeah, I mean, I knew that it existed, but my really one and only introduction to Jonathan Larson is Rent. And Smash. I feel like Smash...
Well, Smash is the unofficial Jonathan Larson biopic, okay?
Exactly. And I
feel the unauthorized.
And it's interesting to think that Smash did that because, what was it, 2012, right?
Yeah, 2012, yeah. 2013, something like that.
But to have their plot line focus, especially in season two, like so heavily on a storyline that was inspired by Jonathan Larson, like, you know, Hit List is kind of Rent and kind of like every other little piece.
Well, it's trying to be. It's trying
Jonathan.
To be.
Jonathan. And, you know, like.
But, you know, you have Jesse L. Martin there in Daphne Rubin Vega. You have a character who dies the night before their first preview off Broadway in a very different way, but still the similar performance that night where they don't do the show. They're going to do it only at their music stands, but then they're overwhelmed and they jump into doing the full staging of the show. It's very like the parallels are so obvious.
Yes, definitely. But yeah. And then obviously after watching this movie, I listened to the original cast recording and also the movie soundtrack. And I think, and I'm sure you can speak to it too, but, I think the movie soundtrack is very well produced. I do think that they did a really good job on that soundtrack, but the differences are definitely there. However, it does stay pretty true to the flow of the original Tick, Tick, Boom, I would say.
Yeah, the order's mixed up a little bit. There's some like additional songs used in the movie and some cut songs as well. And obviously, you know, this was a three-person, very minimally staged show off Broadway. Mm-hmm. That's what the cast recording is from. So you only have three voices playing a bunch of different characters, and you are relying completely on those songs to tell the story and the monologue that goes kind of between them. Whereas the movie, the scope is so much bigger. You have so many more characters. You know, people aren't doubling up and playing multiple people. And what, like, something that's super interesting that they did with the movie is that you see, it's kind of told two ways. You see Jonathan, like, looking back on what happened through the stage show that he's performing, but then you also see what's happening in real time. So sometimes you'll get like, obviously, like something like Come to Your Senses, where Caressa is singing it in the room, and then also Susan is singing it kind of in parallel, and they're paralleling these two moments. So you get kind of that double viewpoint that you just can't get from the stage mm-hmm. show. So they're accomplishing different things.
I mean, I do want to talk about the style that this was filmed. As Steph said, directorial debut from Lin-Manuel Miranda. And, I mean, he really set the standard super high for the rest of the movies that he's going to direct in the future, I think.
And it's also a very, like, directed movie. Like, some movies, like, you don't see a director. But I think you see a director a lot in this movie. I think you see choices so much. Not just when he's the line cook at the diner. You know, throughout the whole movie.
We will get to Sunday. That is an entire segment of its own, Sunday. But I think it also really helps, one, Lin is a musical theater guy. So, obviously, mm-hmm. the correct choice for this movie.
He comes from a place of love. For the genre.
He is a massive Jonathan Larson fan. So, like, who else but Lin is really, in my opinion, what this is? And I do want to touch on what you were talking about with, like, that this movie felt grand. Something that I said to you when we were driving to Shaw Fest was that something that I am so worried about with Wicked, and no, we will not talk about the Wicked casting on this episode. We will save that for a different day. But something that I'm worried about with Wicked is the, like, theatrical and grandness of that storyline. And in my opinion, like, every movie musical after this should watch this movie, because that is how you bring theater into film and correctly. Like, the magical realism that they did, it was so good. I'm thinking of the swimming pool scene, you know, when he was diving in and all of
the music notes
were, like, coming up in the water, like, all the different colors.
The better version of what they were trying to do in the Heights, you know what I mean?
I was gonna say, so it's interesting that In the Heights came out this year because in many interviews for Tick, Tick, Boom, Andrew Garfield says, you know, without a Jonathan Larson, there might not be a Lin-Manuel Miranda. And we know based on, like, interviews with Lin and just, like, hearing about his love for theater over the years that, as I said, huge fan of Jonathan Larson. So there are, like, inspirations in Hamilton, in the Heights, in everything that he probably will work on in the future. But I think it's so interesting that these two movies came out in the exact same year because, to me, and I know that Lin, like, didn't direct In the Heights. Obviously, he had a huge part in the behind the scenes of it. But I wonder.
And they're also wildly different in tone, too. So it's not, like, a perfect comparison.
Very true. But I feel like if he was involved more behind the camera, we might have gotten a better version of In the Heights. I don't know. Like, there are aspects of Tick, Tick, Boom that I feel like, especially that magical realism, I hated it in the Heights, and I was obsessed with it in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I, like, that was specifically what I thought about when the music notes and the numbers were kind of floating in that pool versus, I don't know, what song is it in the Heights where they're drawing, like, animation at the beginning of 96,000 or it's a Benny and Nina duet at one point. And yes. I was like, I don't like this. But this, it almost felt like dream sequency or like,
totally.
You knew it was happening inside his head. Like, you knew that the characters weren't seeing it, but mm-hmm. that it was kind of his vision. Whereas in the Heights, I don't know if they quite got that.
No, the tone was confused. Another song I'm thinking of in Tick, Tick, Boom, No More, which, like, that performance, mm-hmm. stellar. But everything that was going on around them, you know, they start in the apartment, then we end up at like Michael's new apartment, and then we see them in the tuxedos and the big like grand scene that is going on. It just like every single shot and every single scene felt so thought out and so perfectly crafted and like art, basically. I feel like Lin set out to create art because that's how he was inspired by Jonathan Larson. And even just thinking of a line that he says like in the movie when he's fighting with Michael about when he goes to that, like, what is it called,
the like the workshop focus group? Thingy?
The focus group. And then they're like fighting about that, and because Michael's in marketing and he was an actor and whatever, and he was like, what do you do, John? Like, you're an artist. He's like, but I'm an artist, like, that's what I'm doing. And I feel like Lin took that to heart, like, I'm an artist and I'm gonna create art, and please enjoy this. So I do think that all of those like magical realism moments worked so well, but then at the same time the stripped back stuff was also my favorite. And I mean, like, not to get into performances right now, but just to talk about Why, the song Why, and, you know, Andrew Garfield sitting at a piano in the middle of Central Park at the Delacorte Theater, the most simple staging you could possibly ever do, but the scene is absolutely perfect.
Do you think this really happened? Do you think Jonathan Larson actually found a piano on the stage of the Delacorte? This is, like, probably not, but cinematically, and for him to tell the story on stage and Tick, Tick, Boom, like, of course, why not? That, like, that's brings us to the line that is said in narration over the beginning, like, everything you're about to see is true except for the parts Jonathan made up. And, like, maybe that's part of the things Jonathan made up, but it's fine. Like, I'm fine with it.
Yeah, exactly. I do want to talk a bit more about, like, the comparisons to Rent, because I feel like whether this is Lin sprinkling this in. Also, should say right now, this was written, the script was done by Steven Levinson, and we also watched and chatted about another Steven Levinson movie musical this year.
We did, didn't we?
Dear Evan Hansen. And to think that the same person was involved in the scripting of both blows my mind. We won't talk about the differences between those two movies because we really don't need to, but I do think that Steven Levinson's screenplay, really good for this movie. Really good. But to chat about the Rent references, again, I don't know if this was like Steven and Lin's brainchild of we have to put these things in here because like we know they exist because Rent exists, or if these things actually happened. But immediately when the phone rang and they never answered it and the message was speak, I was like, oh my God, Rent. Jonathan calls Michael Pookie, which I think is like so amazing. And I hope that that's real. I hope that someone is around to confirm that that was real. But then just like songs in general, you know, we've got like notes playing in the background of One Song Glory. Like there are so many, No More is Rent, like Rent from Rent. There are so much like instrumental and like inspiration that I guess he obviously took from Tick, Tick, Boom and put it into Rent. And I guess it's just like his musical style is like rock musical theater. So it sort of works for like everything that he created, I guess.
Yeah, like, you know, he was working on developing his musical style while writing Superbia and Tick, Tick, Boom and anything else he wrote and the millions of other songs you can find, not millions, but on the Jonathan Larson project, and kind of his magnum opus, if you will, was Rent. And that was like accumulation of everything that he worked on for his entire life until that moment. So it makes sense that there are some things that Lin probably pulled in here to make references for musical theater fans, but other things that are organic because they were written by the same person.
Exactly. To think that he never, I mean, to think that he never saw Rent is devastating in itself, but to think that he never saw like how much people loved his work is really the most devastating thing to me, because all that he ever wanted was for people to enjoy what he created. And
to see his art.
Exactly. And although like people enjoyed Superbia, not financially enjoyed it, but they enjoyed it. But to think that he had such a smash, you know, a Pulitzer Prize winning musical, so many Tony Awards, like Rent is what, in its 25th anniversary right now? I'm pretty sure they're on the 25th anniversary tour.
2021.
Yeah. So it's, that show's lived on for 25 years. And there is a clip in the movie of Anthony Rapp saying, in Mark costume, saying, like, we dedicate this and every single performance to Jonathan Larson. So I love that those little moments that were for real, like, that happened in real life, were taking actual footage and putting it into the movie. I loved that.
Obviously, Jonathan died in such a tragic way. He had an aortic dissection, believed to have been caused by undiagnosed Marfan syndrome the night before that first Rent preview. But his work lived on and still lives on and will live on probably, hopefully, maybe beyond even his contemporaries and beyond the people who were there to see Rent at that time. So his life was short, but his life will also be long because it's still... we're still thinking about what his artistic output was.
And I love the aspect of very Rent as well, using a video camera. You know, the style changed sometimes when they had, like, the camcorder shots, you know, Broadway cameo from Lauren Marcus, like, filming for Jonathan Larson. So I just think that everything combined was almost a thank you for everything that you did, and also... I don't know. I love the Rent references. I really think that whoever put that in there or didn't put that in there, like, it works perfectly for this movie.
I think, like, I love the use of that video camera almost filter over some parts of the movie, because it's the way that what happened in real life was captured through just friends filming friends. And then we as an audience kind of become those friends seeing it, and then as it transitions into, you know, regular widescreen, but you're it brings you into that world of, this was just a man being filmed by his friends doing, I don't know, normal things, and then that's the only kind of pieces that we have of him performing, and then getting to see, like, the real clips in kind of the over the credits.
There's an amazing side by side. We will put it in the description for our YouTube viewers, of Jonathan Larson and Andrew Garfield singing and performing to 3090. And you can see Andrew took all of the different hand gestures and whatever it might be to create. Yes. Speaking of 3090, let's talk about the songs. What a great way to start off this movie. Again, they had the footage to recreate. And I think... recreating a moment like that, that's so important to the beginning of this storytelling, is perfect to start it off that way. Also, Andrew Garfield is a great singer, and I, again, am shocked by this, but I shouldn't be, because he seems to be good at everything. They're singing happy birthday, you just want to lay down and cry. Not just another birthday, it's 30.
He, like, I feel like he worked really hard at it. You know, like, is his voice, is he Pavarotti here? No, but no one asked him to be. Nobody asked him to be. Because if you listen, the Boho Days is on that, Jonathan Larson singing it is on that original cast recording from the Off-Broadway recording. And his voice, he's not Pavarotti either, okay? He is a passable singer. He is a writer first. And so Andrew
understood the assignment.
Perfectly matched it. And even I was watching with my mom, she's like, oh, he's a good singer. And I'm like, yeah, he did it. He's committing. He's doing, like, you don't feel like he's self-conscious about it. He's, like, fully singing these songs.
And we think learning to play piano for some of that too, which is awesome.
I believe. I had read or heard somewhere that he learned to play piano. I don't know if the shots of his hand are of his hands, but he learned to play the piano a bit.
Yeah. But that song, great. I know a lot of people have been tweeting about the fact, like, what was it? Adele and Tick, Tick, Boom coming out on the same day of turning 30.
Yes, Adele's album 30 and Jonathan Tick, Tick, Boom, which is about, you know, the pressure, the anxiety around turning 30, both coming out on the same day. It's too much for people.
Yeah.
Every day my mom's like, you're 30. And, like, let me tell you, I'm not. I'm not yet 30.
Not yet.
But like, it's a very real thing. It's a very real thing of like the ticking of this like arbitrary number of feeling like you have to accomplish things or feeling like you have to, or you're missing something in your life if you haven't done certain things by 30. So he captured that kind of anxiety, that birthday anxiety.
Also something that I loved throughout this entire movie, not on the cast recording, but the clock ticking in the background. It showed up a lot at the beginning of songs and then like sometimes through scenes as they go on. But in 3090, you know, we also get introduced to two very important side characters, you know, Josh Henry and Vanessa Hudgens grace our screens. And this is, again, someone else. Guys, why are we doubting Vanessa Hudgens in anything anymore? Like, she
never doubt her again. I'll never doubt her again.
Right? Like, the performances that she gives, starting at Rent Live really like turned a corner for her.
Okay, that's right. Grease Live was even before that.
You're right. Her Rizzo and Grease Live was everything.
Sorry, the Princess Switch was even before that. I'm not sure if it was, but
Vanessa Hudgens had a really good Friday, November 19th, because the Princess Switch 3 and Tick, Tick, Boom premiered on Netflix at the exact same time. But yeah, we need to stop doubting her in these things. This is someone that has obviously shown us time and time again now that she has the acting chops and the vocal chops, because she kills it in some of these numbers.
She sounds really good. She sounds really good. And she has such a distinct singing voice, too. You, like, always know it's her singing. Yes. So she sounded great.
Especially in, like, group numbers. You're like, oh, Vanessa's here. We haven't seen her yet, but she's here.
Also, can I shout out, like, her hair? Because it was very 1990.
For some reason, amazing, her
hair,
though.
She did look amazing. Her hair and her full looks were very 1990 to me.
Yes.
Great.
I also love that she was in this because Vanessa has obviously been in Rent twice now. The first time at the Hollywood Bowl, she was Mimi. Second time for Rent Live, she was Maureen. So she has a connection to Jonathan Larson Music as well. Also a connection to Lin-Manuel Miranda. She was in the Kennedy Center in the Heights.
Yeah.
So I think she's perfect casting for this movie. And then Josh Henry, like, what more can I say?
I was trying to find out if he'd ever been in Rent, because it seems crazy he wasn't.
Because,
but I don't think he was.
Collins Wen.
Exactly. Collins Wen. Even like a Benny, I don't know. But give us a Josh
also,
Henry Collins now.
Because we're recording this very close to episode release, if you happen to be in the New York area, go see Josh Henry in Waitress, because that is something to see.
Sierra Renee.
He's perfect.
Crazy casting. Yep. Love him. Every time I hear him sing, amazing. But yeah, you know, this is kind of Lin's MO to cast people he's worked with in the past. And there's a bunch of people who are in the Heights or Hamilton alumni. Bring It On. Shout out to Kate Rockwell. or like Rent alumni, and sometimes both. Sometimes people who've been in both. And so those people all have connections to either him or to Jonathan's work. So the casting is not just, he didn't just think who's best for this part, like he did, but also who has like a meaningful
it's
attachment
intentional.
To these roles.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And then, you know, we get some more Broadway cameos in our next song, which is Boho Days. I loved this scene. I think this is one of the best scenes in the entire movie. And this is sort of what I was talking about of how, like, you know, the magical realism moments work really well, but also the simplistic moments work perfectly. And this is a perfect example of that. You know, it's a party at Jonathan's apartment, really small. Everyone's like super crammed in there, but everyone is just like having a blast.
This is the life of Bo 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 Bo. This is the life of Bo 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 Bo. This is the life of Bo 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 Bo. Bohemia. Bohemia.
One more time.
Bohemia. Bo 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 Bo.
And this is the time to again shout out Robin DeJesus, because
a star. Absolutely.
We love. Yeah, I mean,
again,
I'm
talking about a Rent and In the Heights alum.
Exactly. And I watched him last year. Oh my God, the name is escaping me, of the play that was filmed for Netflix.
Boys in the Band? He was on Boys in the Band?
Yes, Boys in the Band. He was amazing in that too. Wow, Robin DeJesus has a Netflix relationship a little bit here. Good for him. Get that Netflix money. Yeah. Actually, tell the story that you were saying to me about the difference between Robert DeJesus and Andrew Garfield.
Yes, there was an interview with EW. It was Andrew Garfield and Robin DeJesus being interviewed together. They had like three rounds of drinks. And they did a chemistry read for between Robin and Andrew for Michael and Jonathan, because these are best friends from childhood. And after Robin left the audition, you know, he was feeling good about it. He's like, we had great chemistry, like, was very excited about it. And he said what he thought when he left the audition. He's like, wow, I might have health insurance this year. It was funny. It was a funny joke. It was a good joke, Robin. But it was kind of, you know, Lynn cast theater people in this movie. Theater people who have to think about things like that. Who, you know, Andrew Garfield, well, was wonderful in this movie, but is not thinking about things like that for his health insurance.
He is booked and busy always. He's
booked and busy. Shout out to Spider-Man.
We'll see him in theaters back in December.
He's in it. But I that struck me as such a theater person thing to be like, wow, if I get this movie, I'm going to have health insurance. And it kind of like resonated with probably what Jonathan and his friends were thinking about at the time that this story took place.
Totally. And I mean, like, even the theme of, to bring back Rent again, but the theme of Rent is like, how are we going to pay rent? You know, like, it's very prevalent. Obviously, as shown in this movie, like, Jonathan did not pay his rent bills. The electricity gets shut off at one point. Like, so much. I mean, we'll get to the Sondheim-y stuff later, but something that Sondheim says to him is write what you know. And that's what he did with Rent, is he wrote what he knew. But
you see so much of the DNA of that, not even just in what he wrote for Tick, Tick, Boom, but what he was living during this time.
Yeah.
And you can see how it became Rent, you know, the past few notices, everything. The friends, the friendships with people who are sick, all of it.
Yeah, so in Boho Days specifically, you know, most of the people that were sitting around the couch singing in that room were also probably thinking about their health insurance, because all of them, theater actors. I do want to shout out Ben Levi Ross, who is a former Evan Hansen. He's in a very, like, minimal role, but really giving a great performance. And I would love to see him in something else, because it was, like, captivating to watch him do what his maybe 10 lines were.
He was so sweet in this. And, you know, he made me cry. I mean, we'll get to Sunday, but when he comes out in Sunday and, like, Andrew leads him out in Sunday and he's, like, doing his little hat, I was, like, getting emotional over Ben Levi Ross, or Freddie, as it was in that moment.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Just so good.
I mean, also someone to shout out now that was in this scene, and she is wonderful throughout the entire movie, is Alexandra Shipp as Susan. Mm-hmm. I was not familiar with her work before, but, like, what a stunning voice she has. I was so surprised.
Love Simon. That I know,
we say this
with,
like,
you.
I know, but I don't, like, remember. But you said she's starting Cabaret in Love, Simon. Look, like, Love, Victor's really the only things that I remember from Love, Simon at the current moment.
I can't believe you haven't seen Love, Simon 700 times the way I have seen Love, Simon 700 times.
I didn't watch it on the way to Disney World and the way home from Disney World,
like,
7 days apart.
Exactly. Or in theaters. Or every year when I decorate the Christmas tree. Okay, so that's that.
No, not the exact same way. But she was great. She was really good in this movie. I thought that her and Andrew Garfield had amazing chemistry. And that leads me to my next point of a song that was not cut from the movie, but completely changed from the original. And that is Green Green Dress. The way that this song flips from Boho Days into this scene when they're, like, basically having sex to this song is not how it sounds on the original cast recording.
No. I mean, Green Green Dress obviously sounds super, super different, but the Josh Henry doing an R&B kind of arrangement of it, great.
So good.
And then the way that they mixed it on the movie soundtrack, whereas it goes from the end of Boho Days into Green Green Dress, like they're overlapping and you hear people cheering at the end of Boho Days into Green Green Dress. Sounds fantastic.
So good. The green green dress, 24 isn't a strap. The green green dress, what a pleasure to unwrap. The green dress, oh, what it can do. Oh, the green green dress, that's to me on. The green green dress, the green green dress. We have reached basically the point in the cast recording of Sunday, and it is important to discuss that a hero of Jonathan Larson's and a hero of many people is, you know, Mr. Stephen Sondheim, who, I mean, a hero of yours, Steph.
You know I love Steve. I should have worn my Sondheim sweatshirt for this.
You should.
I mean, we'll talk so much about Mr. Sondheim here, but something that was like kind of like fascinating to me that I was thinking about so much watching this movie is Stephen Sondheim was in his 60s at the time, or 60-ish at the time of this story taking place, and he was considered old then. And Steve is still with us, still kicking at 91, still
having Broadway revivals. He's 91.
Showing up to Company on the first
Getting
preview.
Getting a standing ovation walking into Company.
As he deserves. And the way that he is still with us and still writing, and that Jonathan was seen as this like bright young writer who was like not still with us anymore, I thought was like, to see them kind of in the same frame just like kind of breaks your heart. And then you also think about Jonathan Larson was someone who like looked up so much to Stephen Sondheim, and then the way that Lin-Manuel kind of looks up to Jonathan Larson and Stephen, but in the similar way that Jonathan Larson looked up to Stephen Sondheim. And then you think about the new people coming up writing who look up to Lin-Manuel in the way that Lin-Manuel looked up to Jonathan, who looked up to Stephen. And it's kind of like, and all of those things coming together made this movie. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that got me crying watching the movie the other day.
Also, Bradley Whitford giving his best Sondheim.
Just the way he was sitting in the chair and like leaning on his head. That was so Steve. You know, Stephen Sondheim was, and I think is still, so generous with his time and his mentorship to other writers. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a pretty common thing of him to do, to call writers up after seeing their work or after receiving a tape and letting them know, I really like this, or I think you need this, and like being a mentor and like wanting to foster the next generation of artists. And also the way I will recognize that man's voice anywhere, because I knew that was him on the voicemail and I knew it wasn't Bradley Whitford. I'm like, that's Steve. That's, I call him Steve too because we're friends. I was like, that's Steve.
That was his cameo. He was like, cast someone else to play me, but I'll do the voicemail.
Well, you know, he's like 30 years younger. What I heard about the voicemail is that they had sent, I mean, they talked to Stephen Sondheim a lot because he's represented in this movie and he's still alive. So you want it to be authentic what he's represented of as, but they had a different voicemail that was recorded by Bradley Whitford for that moment. And they sent it to Stephen Sondheim and he's like, I would never say that. So he like rewrote it. And sent it, and I was like, okay, we can do this, but we don't have Bradley Whitford again. He's like, I'll record it. So he like rewrote, like he personally wrote that voicemail, trying to like capture what he would have said at the time, and then re-recorded it for its use in the movie. So it, I don't know, I think it's like a nice stamp of approval from Stephen Sondheim, so that we know it's not just like fictional made up of him. It's like, no, he actually thought these things, he actually did these things, he actually like told him, and he would still stand by that, and he would say it again.
Now that we are at the Sondheim section of this discussion, as I said, Sunday, from Sunday in the Park with George, I had no idea that this song was actually on the original Tick, Tick, Boom. No idea. So they watch Sunday in the Park with George with Bernadette Peters and Mandy Patinkin at Jonathan's house, and they're just like commenting on, you know, like how perfect Bernadette is and how wonderful the music is. And never did it cross my mind that we would be getting a Sunday, but if I had bothered to listen to the original cast recording, I would have known. But maybe it was better that I didn't know, because it was like a pleasant
surprise.
Yes. So Jonathan works at the Moondance Diner, which is also, if you are in the New York area, a pop-up shop right now. So
Can
check that out. Yeah, it's like a food truck. That's which awesome. Is really cool. Yeah. So this scene, they're talking about Sunday brunch, hence Sunday. And when the first cameo happens, which I believe is Joel Grey, am I wrong?
No, it's people that I didn't recognize on first glance are the first cameos, is the answer. It's like Chuck Cooper and
Okay, well, the first one that I noticed was Joel Grey. I was like, oh my God, it's Joel Grey. And then the next one, I feel like, was Lynn cooking in the kitchen. I was like, oh, well, Lynn's here because, like, Lynn's trying to put himself in this movie. And then we get Stokes, and then we get...
Stokes. Andre DeShields.
Andre DeShields, most iconic in this entire scene. Like, he's booking a table for his family, and he's not listening to anything that Andrew Garfield is saying. It's amazing.
And Andrew Garfield doesn't care how to spell your last name to get you a table.
Richard.
or, like, Renee Lee Goldsberry and Philippa Sue at the counter...
With the headbands, and then later do the Skylar Sisters Hamilton pose. Then we have, like, Beth Malone in her entire Allison from Fun Home costume. I was like,
that was, like, the weirdest one to me. That was what triggered me to think, oh, they are purposefully representing their iconic characters.
Totally.
Like, they're not just, it's not just, like, Broadway cameos for fun. No. It is, like, with purpose of, you know, it's not just a fun Easter egg to have, you know, them be Angelica and Eliza. It is like, these are iconic roles that are inhabiting that space.
Like Bebe Neuwirth walking out in her Chicago, like, costume. Yes. Like, she was intentionally placed there. And then obviously we get Bernadette, like, in the hat, which is
that was
amazing.
That was the moment. When Andrew, like, as Jonathan, as George, kind of, like, takes her hand, gives her the flower, and, like, leads her up to the stage. I have the list right here. So it's Andre DeShields, Bebe Neuwirth, Beth Malone, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Cheetah Rivera, obviously, giving us her best, like, ladies who lunch with the martini, Chuck Cooper, Howard McGillin, Joel Grey, Renee Lee Goldsberry, Philippa Sue, Felicia Rashad, Bernadette Peters, Adam Pascal, Daphne Brunvega, and Wilson Jermaine Heredia, kind of like popping in at the end.
Nice little Rent reunion there. Yeah.
Yes. And I was like listening, or I was reading articles. There was this article, I believe it's in Vanity Fair, where they did a big photo shoot with a lot of the people in that scene. And like Lynn and Andrew. And they talked about how that scene came together and what the goal of it, what the purpose of it. I read a different article that said that because they had it scheduled pre-COVID and then had to reschedule to do it post-COVID, they lost some of the people. So they had...
Who did they lose?
They lost Joanna Gleason and Chip Zion, like the baker and the baker's wife from the original Into the Woods.
Sorry, Chip.
For scheduling, they couldn't do it. And then they made everyone who was coming into the scene quarantine for 2 weeks before doing it. So a lot of people were like, I have kids. for me to sit in a hotel room for 2 weeks. But they're like, we did it because, like, Vanessa Goldsberry was like, I did it because I would only do it for Lynn and for Jonathan. Because, like, for her to be in Hamilton, to work with Lynn again, but also to be in the closing cast of Rent on Broadway. So that's super important.
And that film version is out there. Like, Renee's Mimi is the one that so many people have seen. Yeah.
Me, that's the one I've seen because I have not watched the movie because it's bad. and that, I'll quote that. But they said the idea was that they wanted these legends of Broadway to be there and people that Jonathan would have seen and would know that are legends, but people that became legends because of work that was inspired by what Jonathan did. So these surrounded by people that, like, in his greatest fantasies, he couldn't even understand or know what would come from what he created.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Lynn, a different interview talking about the same scene, and he had said, you know, this is like past, present, and future Jonathan Larson inspired musicals. He said, I can speak for myself with Hamilton. I can speak for Janine Tesori because she told me like how much we've had those conversations about exactly how much Jonathan Larson inspired Fun Home. But he also said that, you know, Sunday is such a choral song. You need that like big ensemble. And the only way to do that in Jonathan's head was to bring like the best of the best to be the ensemble. On and on in every Sunday. And I think it is like, obviously that's something that is very much for theater fans. If you are just like happen to stumble along this movie, you would know nothing about musicals. These are just people that are singing. But like, I couldn't even keep up counting the number of people that showed up. It was so exciting. And then like 10 minutes before that, we had a workshop scene with Jonathan, which is where we meet Stephen Sondheim the first time. And we've got like the best of the best composers, like Stephen Schwartz, Jason Roberts Brown, like Mark Shaiman, Joe Iconis. Like, it was...
Everyone sitting in that workshop was a writer.
Or
Kiara, who wrote the book to In the Heights.
Nick Blamire, like, everyone was there. There were so many, like, there was so much of a love letter to theater in this movie, which
Dave
I think
Malloy.
Is...
Dave Malloy. Sorry.
Yes. Oh my God, Dave Malloy. I didn't even notice Dave Malloy.
Yeah, he's like Dave Malloy. There's, like, more people that we're not even naming. But these were the ones that I was like, oh, hey.
I know, but it was things that, like... Again, I was watching this with my parents, and I shouted out, like, Stephen Schwartz, and then I was like, oh my God, like, who else is here? Yeah, everyone's here.
It was like, I was not paying attention, but you're just, like, watching that scene, just, like, not really thinking that hard about it. And then you recognize one person, and I'm like, oh, cool, another person. And then by the time I got to Joe Iconis, which is by the end, I was like, oh, I think they're all writers. I think they're all musical theater writers.
Yeah.
Which was fun.
And, Paul Wontorek from Broadway.com did a lot of interviews, and he was saying that a lot of Broadway producers were in there as well, like, in throughout the entire movie. I wouldn't know, but should shout out to, you know, main man on Broadway, Bernie Telsey, because he was a big part of casting this movie as well.
Was
so
he
that,
in the movie? I didn't see him.
He should have been, like, if he wasn't,
like,
Lynn,
that,
come on.
He should have been in the Sunday Legends scene. Let's be real. Bernie Telsey.
The king of New York, Bernie Telsey, obviously. But yeah, I'm sure, I don't know, I always say, I think I had said this on like previous episodes of like Seth Rudetsky's phone contact list. No, it's Lin-Manuel Miranda's Lin's contact
phone.
List. It's crazy. But like so appreciated, and I'm sure every theater actor that also watches this movie is like, oh my God, like my friends are here like supporting art and the music that we love, and a lot of them like are in their 30s, early 40s, and like grew up with Jonathan Larson music. So you're right, like it's totally a tribute to him, and he would have, I'm sure, loved it. So it was, I loved like everything about that scene. And I feel like after that scene, when we get to like the workshops of Superbia, and then we get to like maybe a devastating 25 minutes for the rest of the movie, and it's just like nothing actually, like no one dies on screen. But the way that I was so emotional for a friendship that I, like, we only know the very, very bare minimum about is...
No, but, like, we don't know about their friendship, but, like...
Just friendship
in
general.
We have friends, you know?
We do?
Crazy. Like,
a concept.
You know, so... So, like, we don't know everything about Jonathan and Michael's friendship, let's say, but it's not hard to insert yourself into this friendship where they had this horrible fight, and then the next day... You know, Michael still shows up for him at the workshop and is still like, or when Jonathan's like to him, it's mostly friends. And Michael's like, how horrible.
Also, Sondheim shows up to that workshop. Legendary. Yep. And sadly.
Jonathan's parents show up.
Danny Burstein and Judy Kuhn. Like,
yeah.
What parents? Amazing. But sadly, Susan does not show up for the workshop.
No.
He does reserve a seat for her. But that leads us to what is, I think, maybe the most beautiful song in Tick, Tick, Boom, which is Come to Your Senses. When he is writing this in his apartment, I mean... A subplot to this movie is writing this song. You know, the first time that he performs Tick, Tick, Boom for the all of the writers that we just listed, Sondheim says to him, like, you need like
a song for Elizabeth.
Song, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, Superbia never played, right? I'm not wrong on that.
No, it kind of died here, basically.
Yeah.
What writing Come to Your Senses reminded me of is Roger in Rent trying to write the perfect song.
I'm writing one great song before... Yeah, exactly.
And I get that's probably why he plays like one song, Glory, a little bit, because he's like thinking about writing that song. But, and it reminded me kind of, you know, the way Your Eyes in Rent is kind of like not great of a song, and the way that that is an unfinished musical, with that placeholder song still there, and like what he could have written with something like Come to Your Senses, if he had more time.
You know what? Come to Your Senses could have fit into Rent, though. He could have taken it.
Just like stole it from Suburbia and put it
into
Rent.
Yeah, Suburbia never made it anywhere. It could have made its way into Rent.
Well, he would perform it in Tick Tick Boom. He would perform Come to Your Senses.
You're right.
In Tick Tick Boom.
But the way that that song is presented, I think you said at the beginning of this episode, it's Susan and what's her name? Caressa, right?
Caressa.
Yeah, performing it. So Vanessa Hudgens, again, giving a stellar
nailing
performance on this song.
Come to your senses. 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 Baby, come back. Alive.
In the rehearsal room singing to everybody, and then like Jonathan picturing Caressa singing it
Susan singing it.
Picturing Susan singing it to him. But what I love to back it up a bit is the scene when they sort of like break up and he's trying to write this song. And the breakup is over, that she is moving to the Berkshires, which I assume is like the Hamptons, because I have never heard
I
of
do
this
think
place.
It's like upstate New York, like Jacob's Pillow I'm familiar with as a dance company.
She said that, like,
the water.
You have a vacation home there. So I was like, oh, the Hamptons, kind of, whatever. I don't know New York.
We're not American. We don't know where the Berkshires are.
No.
Highland in Massachusetts, not even upstate New York, Massachusetts. So it's, like, not that far.
She was going, like, no, not, like, a train ride away. But she was going to move there to teach dance, and she was waiting for Jonathan basically to tell her not to go, but he was very busy with his workshop. She should have told him that she was interested in that dance job like 4 days ago, because she was not going to get an answer out of him. He was too busy.
And I mean, I know this is all dramatized for a story
screen,
but to be fair, this was a very busy week in his life, you know.
I know. And she was, and he was like, can you ask them for an extension? And she said no, and I get it, like, you know, a job's a job, but she should have, like,
she should have taken the job much earlier. But like, again, dramatic reasoning for storytelling.
Yes, exactly. So she ends up at his apartment when he's like finally in the zone to write Come to Your Senses. It has not like developed into that yet, but he's like in the zone and he's playing the piano, which is the one song Gloria background, and she comes over and they sort of break up. And like, it's not their final goodbye, because she does come back later, but the goodbye that they have, he starts to play piano on her shoulder, and I love that scene so much, because it just shows you that he could never remove himself from his art, no matter what was happening in his life. This is like the biggest tragedy that he's going through, is like losing the love of his life, and he's playing piano on her arm. So I loved that. And then, you know, we get this amazing number, and I think it was so well done to cut between the two. And again, like the vocal performances from both of them, like really, really good stuff. And yeah, like the workshop goes well. We haven't even talked about that his agent is Judith Light, which is also great. But
yes, that was fun when she showed up. That was really fun when she showed up.
But you know, like he gets this phone call after Suburbia, and she says it was great, but go work on your next one. And this is a musical that he spent 8 years writing. Now, Suburbia, like, not revolutionary. I do think that maybe it could work now, just because there's a lot of different, I don't know, like, takes on musicals these days, and it could be interesting to bring something like that.
It's a lot easier to do something high tech on a budget now, whereas when he was wanting to do it, it would have been extremely expensive.
Yeah.
So yeah, just the way theater has evolved. He wanted a huge cast too, and just yeah, he had these like big dreams, but he had to be able to start somewhere where someone would be able to invest. Mm-hmm. Not billions of dollars in his
show.
But,
you know, after this, he does, like, make up with Michael, and that's when he finds out that Michael has AIDS. And this was, like, a conversation that they should have had days ago, but Jonathan was too busy, and Michael
It was a busy week, guys. Jonathan was busy.
I know, but like...
No, these are important things.
That's a life event. Not a good life event that's happening. But it's interesting, too, that the way that played out, because like Michael respected that he was busy and didn't want to ruin something that he had worked on for so long. Because I think if we were... Obviously, we don't know because it never happened. But if he were to tell him what was going on before Superbia, like, I'm not sure that that workshop would have ever went on. Not sure that Sondheim would have ever saw it to leave that message for him to be like, let's chat. So... You know, everything happens for a reason. So I wonder if that was something that like played out exactly the way that it should have. But I loved the scene when Robin DeJesus sings Real Life. He's like really giving a great performance in that number, and just the like differences. You see like both of their characters going through the emotions very differently. And then, as I said, leads us to which like why it in itself is such an amazing and powerful scene. I love that it starts raining when he's singing and then he shows up at his door like soaking wet. And the only thing that Michael says to him is, what are you wearing? Like, why are you wearing that? He's telling him that he doesn't know how much longer he has to live. And all he cares about is like what he's wearing. So it's, I don't know. I think from like that moment until the end was kind of a very emotional roller coaster. And then we end up with what you had said was the one song that you knew, Louder Than Words. And that whole, I think, like 6 minutes is perfect. And I have never been so emotional to hear Happy Birthday play in my entire life.
Can I tell you, like, how dumb I am? I never realized it was Happy Birthday until watching this movie. Like, listening to this song, like, you know, years of my life. Never realized. Because I just wasn't thinking about that. Like, I conceptually knew that the musical was about kind of, like, the ticking clock before you turn 30. However, like, it did not occur to me that that's what that little melody at the end was. That song, to me, Louder Than Words, is, like, super, like... earnest and a little bit cheesy, but in a wonderful, amazing way, if that makes sense. It, you know, what does it take to wake up a generation? Like, it's very much trying to be this like anthem. Love, baby, don't say the answer. Actions speak louder than
It's very and Rent, though, too, right? Like, is. Rent has so many lyrics like that.
Rent is so cheesy. Rent is so cheesy. Like, it is in, like, the best way possible. I don't know. I'm obsessed with it. I love it so much. I listen to it all the time.
I can't believe you didn't know it was Happy Birthday. That got, like,
I'm dumb sometimes. It didn't occur to me.
I was done after that, and then they also had, like, Alexandra Shipp do the sort of, like, narration at the end of, like, this is what actually happened, he tragically died, and...
You know, also, this is a musical about turning 30, and his, you know, Stephen Sondheim iconically has a musical about
turning 35.
And so, like, plot-wise, like, they're very different, but at the core of them, they're both about... feeling this like upcoming deadline, and you don't know what you need to do to hit it, and trying to figure out all these things. And they're very, very different shows musically, everything, but they are about, you know, a man trying to reckon with his age. And I also think, like, I don't think that's a coincidence in any way that they picked a birthday, and that they have such symbolism with a birthday, this like milestone event that happens in your life, to kind of build these shows around. And also, I know Raul Esparza wasn't the original Bobby, nor was he the original Jonathan, but that Raul Esparza kind of got to do Tick, Tick, Boom in 2001, and then 5 years later got to do Company on Broadway.
Why wasn't he in Sunday?
Where was the Raul Esparza? What was his, what should his iconic look have been in Sunday, if you had to pick one?
What's that musical?
He was like
that
a suit and Bobby. Taboo.
No, Leap of Faith. That's the outfit.
Or, like, wasn't he on Law and Order? So, like, whatever he wore in Law and Order.
I don't
know. Raul Esparza should just be in everything, and he should have been
in this. I'm actually surprised that he wasn't in this, because Raul, like, during the, like, height of the pandemic was literally in every single live stream. So, like,
remember
where was he?
He hosted Stephen Sondheim's 90th birthday party. He couldn't get his thing to work, so they just, like, aired the clips all together.
The way that every single Broadway legend referred to him as "Happy Birthday, Steve." My favorite Steve. Part of that.
When we were watching the movie, I was watching with my parents, and there was like someone was there that night, and I was like, "Steve." My dad's like, "Who's Steve?" Like, just wait. Steve is coming. Yeah, honestly, this movie was wonderful, and just then at the end, you know, you get to see the few clips of Jonathan that they share to kind of show looking. Like, doing what we saw just happen. And the whole movie, I'm like, Andrew looks so much like Jonathan Larson. And then I see those clips, and I'm like, he actually doesn't. But he, like, captured him, you know? That he made me think he looked like him because he embodied him so well. And then I saw their face next to each other. I was like, they don't look alike at all.
No.
Just the haircut.
Yeah.
Whoever did the hair, nailed it.
Great job. Yeah, he did say that, you know, when he got some of the source material to, like, study Jonathan's mannerisms and everything, he was like, this feels like my long-lost brother. This is a guy that, like, I knew in some lifetime. But again, that could be just him being, like, dramatic in his interviews.
For the thing. He's so dramatic in interviews. I'll tell another story that I, on the EW interview with him and Robin DeJesus, about how Lynn had seen him play Prior Walter in Angels in America. And he said, okay, that's my guy from, like, just watching him in that. And when Andrew was talking about it, he said Angels in America and Tick, Tick, Boom are in the same cinematic universe because they take place in a similar time period. And they are about kind of about the AIDS crisis in the 80s and 90s. And he said getting to play Jonathan was like not having to say goodbye to Prior Walter so soon, because Jonathan was someone whose like work was to remember the stories of people who had HIV and had AIDS. So by playing Jonathan, he was like keeping Prior Walter alive for him. And I'm like, Jonathan, I'm like, Andrew, this is so dramatic, but also like, catch me crying.
Cries.
So
also, you know what I just thought about as you were saying that? Beth Malone was in Angels in America. So a little reunion for the two of them.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. Also amazing that here's the thing. Andrew Garfield, not a musical theater guy. Obviously, he's been in a few plays. But for him to just, like, absorb and learn and love so quickly, I feel like it doesn't bother me that, like, a musical theater person was not cast for this role, because he gave us everything that we wanted.
He seems to have so much, like, respect for everyone in there. He worked so hard to get up to par to be able to perform in this, and he's been talking so excitedly in interviews about seeing Bernadette and having all these legends surrounding him, and how he would ask the Broadway people on set to like sing for him. So he like ingratiated himself into the culture of theater, whereas like, I don't know, sometimes you hear of people starring in musicals who were like, we're getting movie actors for this for a reason. Yeah. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with theater.
Dear Evan Hansen.
You know, it like the tone of the way that they talked about the performers in both of the, like this and Dear Evan Hansen, like you said, is so different.
Yeah.
And when they talk about this, they have so much respect for the theater actor. And in Dear Evan Hansen, when they were talking about it, it felt like they did not have respect for the theater actor. So it, like another success with this one, and another not so much success.
I mean, Andrew Garfield does not know the Phantom of the Opera, so like maybe he should get on that, because that is like,
look,
one
Andrew,
that
see
everyone
it once
knows.
And you're fine, okay? See it once
exactly.
And you're fine. But see
and
it
also,
in New York when they're on when
with
the original
staging.
Set.
Exactly. I would love to see him do another movie musical. Like, I'm gonna put that out there. I think that he is like really, he's a very like adaptable person, and like just watching how amazing this performance was, I would love to see him in something else. I would love to see him up on stage. I think he might actually be good in a musical live on stage.
I worry about his stamina.
His stamina, he was whipping himself around. No, in this movie specifically, he was whipping himself around.
8 shows a week vocally, that's what I worry about for him. I know
Angels in America was like 7 hours long every day.
It's 8 hours. And you eat, and it's like a 1 hour break, and you eat lunch, like dinner at the theater, you don't leave. So that also shows his commitment. Yeah. And he did that for, because he did it in the West End, and he did it in New York, so we did it for a long time.
Yeah, it is out there somewhere because it was in movie theaters. We did not see it in theaters because...
No, I haven't seen it.
An eight-hour experience.
It's really long.
It is taped, I know. So it is out there somewhere. I just don't know where. Maybe it's more readily available in the UK because that's who filmed it and put it on. But
that's who always tapes everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it just like made me appreciate like him as an actor for being so committed to this role. So I would love to see him in something else. But I feel like that brings us to the end of our rave review on Tick, Tick, Boom. And just to put it out there, like the reviews came out, I want to say like the embargo was dropped like 2 weeks before it came, maybe a week and a half before it dropped on Netflix. I've never seen this many rave reviews for a movie musical ever, so we were so excited walking in and to know that it is everything that we wanted and more, like, that never happens. It never happens, so I'm, like, thrilled that this was the end result.
Maybe in our year-end review, we'll rank all the new movie musicals of this year, just like
a hypothesis. Will we have seen West Side Story by then? Yeah,
not sure. Maybe.
We'll see. Yeah. It's in theaters only, so we're going to have to trek it to the movie theater.
Maybe we'll go to a drive-in, but it would be cold. Never mind. We'll go. I would go to a movie theater. Actually, let's go to our obsession of the week. We'll talk about being inside.
Okay, great. Wait, before we go to our obsession, we have to rate it.
We haven't rated it. Okay. Okay, I'm going to give it 5 out of 5 green dresses. I know, like, 2 episodes in a row, 5 out of 5, but I just feel so happy watching this, though, and I felt so happy watching La La Land last week. So 2 5 out of 5s in a row from me.
Yeah,
green dress.
No surprise, I am also giving this a 5 out of 5. To me, as I said, this is a perfect movie musical. I think this movie is a masterpiece. I don't know what I should rank it. Oh, we never even talked about this scene, but my metric for this is Vanessa Hudgens' face acting during Therapy.
Watch, oh my God, that. Therapy? That was so good. The choreo in Therapy. The choreographer, because it's not so much dance choreography, except for kind of when we see Alexander Shipp. But it's just movement and capturing, like, how real people and not dancers would move to things. So the choreographer's name is Ryan Heffington, and his most famous previous credit was the Chandelier video by Sia with
Maddie Ziegler.
So I loved what he did with the choreography in this, the way that it felt, like, very human. And we talk about Therapy, which is supposed to be 2 non-dancers, 2, like, singers or a singer and a writer doing this intense head, eyeball, arm choreography movement. Wonderful, fantastic, amazing.
So the metric, obviously, her face acting, because honestly, to get the full picture, like, you have to watch the full scene. She's doing some really amazing things with her eyes, so yeah, go watch that. But and also go watch Tick, Tick, Boom, because if you haven't heard how much we loved it by this episode, like, go read every other review that's out there. And with that being said, it is now time for our obsession of the week.
Okay, so I'll go first, as I always do. My obsession this week, you may know that we went to in-person theater for the first time.
Shocking.
This past weekend, we were indoors, and my obsession is the way that Shaw Festival handled us being inside. So we saw 2 shows there. We saw Christmas Carol, and there were many moments where actors came in from the audience and were close to us, but whenever an actor was in the audience, they were wearing a mask the whole time, and only once they got on stage and they had that distance from the audience did they take off their masks to perform. I absolutely loved just that, like, small thing. It was a very small house, so everyone was pretty close. We were not, like, immediately next to people. They were selling full capacity, but they kept people separated because they had the option to for this performance. And I felt, like, really, really respected by the theater, by Shaw Festival and by the theater and what they were giving us. Everyone in the theater wore a mask the whole time.
I know.
That was really exciting to me.
The horror stories that we've heard from the UK and, like, not so much New York, because I think New York audiences are being very respectful, but West End theater, if anyone's listening to us in the West End, wear your mask indoors.
It's crazy. everyone in there, except for, like, taking it off to take a bite of a cookie, like, wore their mask
also,
the whole time.
The children were wearing their masks, so
no complaints whatsoever. They checked our vaccine status before everyone went in, so you felt confident that you were as safe as you possibly could. Like, seeing theater is kind of one of the safest things you can do right now because everyone is vaccinated and everyone is wearing a mask. And if you're at a company like Shaw, where they're taking audience safety so much into account and showing you that they are, I felt so safe. And then that night we went and saw Holiday Inn, which was a much bigger theater. And again, everyone wearing their mask the whole time. We were at the, like, after party for opening night, and it was, like, more crowded then as well, but they had a lot of outdoor space designated for everyone. I felt like super, super safe the whole time. And my obsession is Shaw Festival for making us feel safe the whole time, because not everyone's doing that. And it made me feel, okay, I can go inside. I can continue to go inside to see theater. Because again, one of the safest things you can do is go see theater because you are vaccinated, wearing a mask.
Totally. And go support your local theaters wherever you're listening to us from. If you do happen to be in Ontario and kind of close to the Niagara Falls area, both A Christmas Carol and Holiday Inn are playing until December 23rd. There are still tons of tickets available, so go and see.
Both were so fun. Like, honestly, so fun. Holiday Inn, an absolute blast. With past guest of the podcast, Vanessa Sears, in it.
Who we met in person, by the way.
I know, it was exciting. We've only, like, virtually met so many people, so hopefully soon we'll start to, like, really meet people in person. And Christmas Carol in the afternoon, past guest of the podcast, Kelsey Verzotti, was in that too. So just seeing all of our friends get to perform was really exciting.
Wow, my obsession feels very lame in comparison to this, like, lovely Ontario theater obsession. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, November 23rd. Tuesday, November 23rd was also the day of the Grammy nominations. Oh. I have to talk about the Queen, Olivia Rodrigo, and her 7 nominations, because the last time we talked about High School Musical, the musical, the series, we had not seen the season finale. And I know that you love the song too, Steph, and my obsession this week is Second Chances from High School Musical.
The way I sing
musical
this song
series.
Every day.
I got a second chance to fly. I got a second chance to fall. I wonder what can make the tide turn, what can make the fire burn. A second chance is all I'm finding.
It's on many of my Spotify playlists.
Also, the way that we both, like, live for Sour, I am, like, so excited for her. This is so big to have 7 Grammy nominations. She is so young. And you know who is so happy that they signed her on for a third season? Disney Plus.
I really was not expecting the Grammys to go for her. I really did not think they were going to go for this album or driver's license. So I'm very happy that they did.
I know. It's so exciting. But High School Musical, the musical, the series, I think we might touch on a little bit more in our year in review because we really have not talked about it. But it did end on a cliffhanger. There will be a season 3. We do know that they might be performing Frozen based on Disney Plus's, like, Instagram posts.
Clues.
But
they're worse than Taylor Swift right now with our leaving us Easter eggs, okay?
But this song, Second Chances, I think is probably the best original song from season 2. Everything else was, like, kind of not that great, but this was really fun. It's Olivia Rodrigo, Josh Bassett, Matt Cornett, and Sophia Wiley. The, like, fun thing about that song is that everybody has, like, their own specific lines, and they all,
like, motif
come in at certain times.
The layering. I gotta do what I want.
Begin again, the best one.
Begin again. I gotta do what I want.
Yeah. Exactly. So I feel like it is appropriate to celebrate Olivia by giving her my obsession of the week. And I can't wait for High School Musical, the musical, the series, season 3. Even though we were like indifferent to season 2, I will still watch that show until it is no more.
100%. Also, shout out to like Barlow and Bear for this morning.
Getting yes! Grammy okay, that while, was, while like, we're just
so
like...
so exciting here, while we're talking about the Grammys.
The unofficial Bridgerton musical album is nominated, which is so exciting. Like, crazy. This is a show that absolutely can crazy probably never be made ever because of like licensing rights and like unofficial everything. What was the funniest thing was the way that the nominations went, they had like those albums and then they also had like soundtracks, and like Bridgerton was also nominated, and I thought that they were nominated for 2 Grammys but then realized that Bridgerton actually existed. Bridgerton. Yes, as for like score or but, whatever.
I mean, as like the world's biggest Bridgerton fan here and on this podcast, me, Chris Van Dusen, the showrunner, like tweeted a congratulations to Barlow and Bear for their nomination. So I was like, oh, this is so sweet. Like,
that's so exciting.
I know. It was like, oh, so, you know, it's like another thing. Like, he so Julia Quinn created this art that then was inspired Chris Van Dusen and Shonda Rhimes to make this TV show that then inspired these other people to create this other art. And it's just like, it's exciting. It's kind of
look
the same thing we're
talking about. Look at you with this segue, bringing it all 360. Yes. That is our full thoughts and feelings on Tick, Tick, Boom, the movie, and also our obsession of the week. As I said, only one movie musical left for this year, and it is West Side Story. And we are not as excited walking into West Side Story as we were for Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yeah, I don't know why, but I'm like very hesitant about West Side Story for some reason.
It's so, the accents for me, and...
The accents, and it just looks very squeaky clean, the trailers. And I want some grittiness in my West Side Story. It's about gangs, so I mean, need some grittiness.
In Steve Sondheim we trust, but do we also trust in Steve Spielberg?
A lot of Steves here. No.
I wonder if they talked to Sondheim. I'd be interested to know. I'm sure they did.
I would say probably. I would say probably.
Yeah.
But we shall see.
We will not be doing a full episode on the West Side Story movie, but hopefully we'll have seen it by our year in review. But if not, we can guarantee that after the new year, we will be doing an Oscars episode because it has been the year of the movie musical, and it will be so exciting when award season hits. We will not...
We didn't even talk about Andrew's potential Oscar chances. We'll talk about it later.
We will talk about it later, but in my opinion... pretty high. I think his chances are pretty high.
I think he's guaranteed a nomination. I don't know about Best Picture, but I think Andrew for sure will be in.
100%. So yeah, if you have seen Tick, Tick, Boom, if you have not seen Tick, Tick, Boom, let us know, and you can do that by following us on Instagram and Twitter at Off2BYPodcast. That's with the number 2.
And you can listen to our podcast anywhere podcasts are found, including the Spotify, Apple Podcasts. And we would love it if you would leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, or even subscribe to us on YouTube, where you can watch and see our beautiful faces as we talk about theater and anything like that.
And our next episode, and I am so excited to announce, is Come From Away, because guess what? We're going to reopening night. I cannot wait. I am so excited to sit and bawl my eyes out in this theater.
We're in like the second row because we're crazy. So catch us at the Royal Alex, okay?
December 15th, we will be there, and then you can hear all of our thoughts on this incredible Canadian musical like that following Monday. So make sure that you do all of those things. Subscribe, follow, all of that, and we will see you guys next time.
Bye.